Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Kevin Phillips is probably best known for his 1969 book, The Emerging Republican Majority. In it, he argued that the southern states of the U.S., which had helped Nixon take the White House in 68, would keep the Republicans winning presidential elections for decades by feeding on the racial resentment of white voters. Though his advice proved so successful that it brought us Trump a half century later, over time, Phillips grew disillusioned with the Republican Party. In the 90s and early 2000, Phillips became a regular guest of Bill Moyers, where they discussed his evolving thinking as laid out in books such as The Politics of Rich and Poor, Wealth and Democracy, and his damning take on W. Bush, American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money. Here's my April 2008 conversation with him regarding his book Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism, in which Phillips did a good job of pointing to the failures of our economy, which would lead, in September of that year, to the fall of Lehman Brothers and the global financial crisis. Kevin Phillips passed away October 9, 2023, at the age of 82. In the second half, you'll hear my 2007 conversation with economist Robert Frank on two of his books. First, in The Economic Naturalist, he asks real-world questions. Why did the keypads on drive-up cash machines have braille dots? They're drive-up cash machines. Why do brides spend a small fortune on gowns while guys just rent tuxes? He offers answers in story form, and it's his way of teaching economic principles, principles that can help us understand daily life as well as big questions. And second, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. Although middle-income families weren't earning much more than they did several decades ago, they were buying bigger cars, bigger houses, bigger appliances, the newest high-tech gadgets. They were moving into more expensive neighborhoods for better schools. They were spending more than they earned. In the book, Frank explores the very meaning of happiness and prosperity in America and explains how increased concentrations of income and wealth at the top had set off a chain of trickle-down expenditures for the less well-off, thus dropping them into enormous debt, many living off the refinancing of their homes. In essence, Frank was also revealing financial and consumer trends that would lead, in their own way, to the crash of 2008. We know this much. The deepening recession isn't just about subprime mortgages. It's not limited to the United States, and it's likely to get worse. Kevin Phillips strikes me as wise and well-informed with a historical perspective and a commitment to the common good. I learned a lot in his newest book, Bad Money, but nothing that might ease our anxiety. In it, he describes the consequences of our misguided economic policies, our mounting debt, our collapsing housing market, our threatened oil, and the end of American domination of world markets. The emergence of a globally dependent U.S. economy dominated by a financial sector rife with extreme risk, debt, deceit, and lack of accountability has failed the American people and pointed the U.S. economy toward a global crisis. And sadly, the debt disaster is a moving train still picking up steam. I hope to ask Phillips why it happened, where we stand, and what we might expect in the days and months ahead. For more than 35 years, Kevin Phillips' insight into American politics and economics has helped to make history as well as record it. His best-selling books, including The Emerging Republican Majority in 1969, The Politics of Rich and Poor in 1990, The American Theocracy in 2006, have influenced political campaigns and changed the way America looks at herself. He's currently a regular contributor to the LA Times, National Public Radio, and writes for Harper's Magazine and Time. We'll focus this time, as I said, on the ideas in his newest book, Bad Money. Welcome again, Kevin Phillips.
Nice to be with you.
Okay, I like listeners to get to know the people behind the ideas. And early on, you were a political strategist for Richard Nixon. We've talked before when I've had you on about the evolution in your perspective over the years. But today, could you just share with us how you decided that your best role was outside the political process, more as an observer, a commentator, a historian, rather than as a player?
Well, I think that's sort of a multi-stage transformation, I'd have to say. After the whole crisis of Watergate and Vietnam and the sort of breakdown of American confidence in the 1970s. I really couldn't see myself getting back into electoral politics in any way. I continued to be a Republican. I voted for Reagan twice, but I didn't agree with a number of his policies, particularly in the economic realm. Then the Bushes came along, and that was even harder for me. And by this point, I was drifting away from the Republican Party. Again, particularly on economics, I saw things building up that I didn't like, and actually what's occurring now is probably the consummation of a lot of what I thought was a problem. In 1990, I wrote a book about the weakness of the economic policies under Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and Richard Nixon actually gave me the lead quote on the back of the book jacket. So my evolution, while it was considerable, wasn't out of sync with somebody whose Republican ancestry went back several decades. And I didn't care that much for Bill Clinton, but to me, the absolute worst president to get in this period of crisis was George W. Bush. And we had, my wife and I, by that point, left Washington. I was totally sick of it, and moved to Connecticut. But as these things came together, I found myself drawn back in. And what I did was really much more a combination of history and economics and politics that you didn't have to be in Washington to do. You had to get into the history and the circumstances. And in some respects, a certain amount of detachment was probably a benefit. And this is my fourth book in a series which started in 2002. And they each came during election years, and they each tried to draw a picture that was focused in particular on one major difficulty that was facing the political system. And I think it helped me to be out of Washington to do this, and I've wound up as an independent. I think at this point we probably need a Democrat in the White House, but I'm not so sure I can see how one is going to get there.
Wow. That last comment surprises me. I will tell you, I'm speaking with Kevin Phillips, by the way. I will tell you that I just saw Frank Luntz speak, and he said that he favored and expected Obama to be president. You just said that I can't quote it, but you said you think it might be difficult for them to take back the White House.
Well, you do have this huge division, and I would say that the only thing that probably repairs the division is for Obama and Hillary Clinton to get together. I'm not certain how this would happen. I think Obama seems to still have, I won't say a lock on the nomination, but is the strong favorite. But his former pastor in motion, this fellow, he just loves the limelight.
That's exactly right.
There. And he's enjoying that, and Obama is not going to profit from that. There are a lot of things that he was too slow to come to grips with, and that's probably the biggest of them. And even if John McCain doesn't want to use that as an issue, I think that a lot of conservative groups and Republican auxiliaries will.
Yeah, of course.
I think it'll be somewhat effective.
Mm-hmm. I guess we'll see how that one plays out. When we spoke in 2006 about your last book, American Theocracy, as I recall, we dealt very briefly with the religion piece and devoted the bulk of our time to oil and debt. And this book seems to have grown out of those two strands.
Yes, but in turn, those two strands grew out of other things I'd been getting into. One of the centerpieces in American Dynasty in 2004 about the Bush family was how they rose on oil.
Mm-hmm.
And the prominence that oil was occupying, which was ever greater in U.S. politics, and that we had a president and a vice president from the oil industry. So my views on both the debt and the irresponsible finance issue and the oil issue and what it represented, I guess have been coming together across a pretty broad spectrum for a couple of decades. But clearly this was the decade that accelerated it.
Right. And let me read a quote from you, and then I'll let you just deal with each one of these in turn. This is a quote. My summation is that American financial capitalism, at a pivotal period in the nation's history, cavalierly ventured a multiple gamble. First, financializing a hitherto more diversified U.S. economy.
Second, using massive quantities of debt and leverage to do so. Third, following a stock market bubble with an even larger housing and mortgage bubble. Fourth, roughly quadrupling U.S. credit market debt between 87 and 2007. And fifth, consummating these events with a mixed fireworks of dishonesty, incompetence, and quantitative negligence. First, this point that you make, which I have to admit was new to me, was the financializing of the U.S. economy, the shift from, as the dominant player in the American economy being making things or even serving people into moving money around.
Well, I think that's right, and that's a central part of what's gone wrong. If you go back and you look at the 1970s, at that point in time, manufacturing was 25 to 27% of the gross national product, and finance was only 10 to 12. And now you jump ahead to the 2000s, and you've got finances up at 20 to 21%, and manufacturing has slipped back to 12%. We are a nation now that moves money around. And in some ways, the biggest part of the financial sector is the debt and credit industry, mm-hmm. whether it's mortgage or it's credit cards or it's all the brokerage firms or all the people that behind the scenes come up with all these, I won't call them crazy, but they're certainly pretty precarious securitized instruments.
Mm-hmm. And so basically, you know, what does America make? America makes debt. So that's the shift toward the financial sector. And as you point out, we now gear our economy, still the largest economy, single country economy in the world, to what is a very volatile sector.
It's not only a volatile sector. Historically, it's been a sunset sector. In other words, countries that have built things and grown things and caught things and produced things, as they develop a global supremacy, turn more towards the fruits of that supremacy, which is finance and financial services and commercial relationships and so forth. And what generally happens, and oversimplifying, but what generally happens is they overreach in terms of global commitment, too many troops, too much hubris, too much imperialism, and to pay for it all requires more and more debt. And the United States in the last 40 years has just increased the debt burden at the same time as, for one reason or another, the average family has most of the time stagnated in terms of income and had to start borrowing. And debt has ballooned pretty much at the same pace that people have either felt they needed to borrow or they borrowed in order to be able to consume more. And those are both troubling dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was the blip when during the Clinton years, I mean, he actually left the White House with a net surplus, not erasing the national debt over time, but a surplus. Yet that didn't really change the movement of things, did it? In other words, the long-term trends that you're talking about.
No, because there's an unfortunate dynamic to this. The reason that he was able to get the budget deficit down is that the tech stock boom and the larger financial boom that underlay it produced so much of an inflow of capital gains tax receipts that it was enough to bring the deficit down. The difficulty was that another part of this boom involved a massive increase in private debt, mostly financial debt, but also mortgage borrowing, which is household borrowing. And this became then the next bubble. After the tech bubble collapsed in 2000, Clinton was still president. By 2001, Alan Greenspan, seeing that you were having a pretty bad implosion in the stock market, decided to gin up the real estate side. And basically what they did is they orchestrated a second bubble. So, yes, I think that the Clinton administration, certainly without designing it that way, became part of a sequential bubbling of the American economy and part of the transfer of power away from the old sectors, especially manufacturing to finance. Finance flourished under Clinton.
Right. And that covers, we've gone through 1, 2, 3, 4 is the quadrupling of U.S. Debt between 87 and 2007. And then we come to dishonesty, incompetence, and quantitative negligence. You have been, you write in this book, and you've been talking about it in your interviews, about cooking the books. And I think this, again, is something that will be, that'll, that is, should be, people should know it, but I think it's going to be news to a lot of people. What do you mean? How have we been cooking the books in terms of information in this country on finances?
Well, it's a multi-tiered problem. You've had cooking the books in the most simple way in terms of federal economic statistics. I have some of this in the book, but I did a big story that's the cover story in Harper's this month on what they call, entitled, The Numbers Racket. And it's talking about the consumer price index, unemployment numbers, and gross domestic product numbers. And to make a long story short, that's where you can argue there's been a lot of cooking in the most obvious sense. And one of the people who was quoted in there is Barack Obama's principal economic advisor, Austin Goolsbee, who said that the Bush administration cooked the books in terms of minimizing unemployment early in this decade. You've also had an enormous amount of gamesmanship coming out of the financial sector in terms of all these things that Americans have just started to understand that have come into existence, all kinds of exotic derivatives, derivative instruments, things like mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations. These things are all trillion-dollar experiments, and the experiments haven't done very well. And that's the problem. They put this stuff out without understanding how it was going to work. The federal government, especially the Federal Reserve Board, went along. Greenspan would not regulate it. So all of this stuff builds this new bubble, and it's worse in terms of the implosion that's coming than we had with Enron and some of the games that came out of the late 1990s bubble.
Okay, I want to talk specifically about a couple of things you just mentioned there. Let me amplify them and see if I've got this right. One of the things that goes in that is a result of that cooking of the books, in other words, when we start changing the way that we define the consumer price index and the cost of living and so on, that actually hurts people who are either on pension, Social Security, and so on that have things gauged to the cost of living. So it isn't just a number. It actually affects people's lives.
Well, it's very significant. You've got, first of all, I think a growing belief that instead of 2 to 4%, the inflation rate is certainly 5% and probably somewhere in the 6 to 9%. Now, if you take that, the ripple effects of having done that for 10, 15 years, this gamesmanship, Social Security payments should be a lot higher. Pensions should be a lot higher. Cost of living increases should have been much bigger. So an awful lot of people are paying the price for that. A lot of retirees are paying a second price in that because inflation was sort of faked into a lower echelon than it really was, you had lower interest rates. Now, that was very good for the people in the financial sector because that enabled them to get money at very low rates and then invested in all kinds of gimmicks. But at the same time, you had people in Sun City, Arizona, or Southern California, Florida, retirees who were getting peanuts on their CDs. And when you favor the financial sector with low rates, you tend to disfavor savers and especially retirees who get peanuts in terms of interest, when in fact the inflation rate is a lot higher. So the seniors are being clobbered about three ways to Christmas.
Right. What about the numbers that they won't even tell us anymore? That the M3. What's going on there? Again, this is something that you're not going to find except maybe on page 30 of a newspaper.
Well, M3 is something that's very significant. We used to, until 2006, had three versions of calculations of the money supply. M1, that was very simple and didn't go too much beyond currency and its equivalents. M2, which was a bit bigger in terms of picking up bank CDs and so forth. And then M3, which began to get into the loans and levels of debt and credit coming out of banks. Now, M3, they decided that they wouldn't publish after early 2006. And if you just look at M1 and M2, which don't reflect anything very much of gaming in the financial system, you don't have a huge growth in the money supply, or you haven't most of the time. But M3 started really soaring in 2006.
And that's when they stopped telling us about it.
Yes, and that's right, exactly. And at this point now, it's clear that we have a much broader-based inflation. But in order to pretend that that wasn't the case, it was a lot easier if you didn't have M3 coming out in 2007 showing 12-14% year-over-year growth.
So yeah, as you said.
This is almost fraud statistically.
That's what I'm saying. In other words, as soon as it started diverging from the other two, they just stopped giving it. What did they tell people, and why have... I mean, one of the questions that always comes up in this kind of an interview, Kevin, is why has everyone stood for it? Why isn't there, either from the media, from economists, from the Democrats, from sound-thinking Republicans, why isn't there more of an uproar?
Well, the media have trouble describing it because they'd have to get into lengthy descriptions of how these things have been slowly but surely modified. The CPI is probably the easiest to explain if somebody wants to, but the consequences of explaining it become very difficult. Secondly, neither of the political parties has totally clean hands here. If you go back and look at what happened under which administration, more happened under Republicans, but that was partly because they were in office for more time.
Right.
You had some of this under Bill Clinton, and you had rising inflation, which just left Jimmy Carter in the 1970s sort of stunned. So it's not that the Democrats have been as much involved, but they don't have clean hands, especially if you're somebody like Hillary Clinton, who was there when a lot of these things were changed in the late 1990s.
Right. Okay. How about, and this is, again, I think, going to be new to a lot of people. This is Terry McNally talking to Kevin Phillips about bad money. How about the way that this is one that I don't think we have the complete information on, but about the Fed sort of putting its own hand on the scale, that there's a working group that was created that perhaps deals in the stock market when it needs to. Talk about that.
Yes, this is the president's working group on the financial markets, and it was set up in 1988 after the 1987 very brief stock market crash. And there's some thought, and I believe it, that the Federal Reserve Board actually intervened in this period by buying Standard & Poor's futures, stock market futures, and supported the market that way. Well, what they did in 1988 is they set up the president's working group, and you didn't hear very much about it, but there were a couple of stories that gave it serious attention, that it had a war room and that it had files with the names of everybody who counted in finance around the world, and that it held sort of fire drills and everything like that. Recently, there's been more speculation in 2001, right after 9/11, and then in the last year and a half, that they were back in action again, and that they were very conspicuously intervening at certain points, and that reports of this intervention were coming from people in the commodity futures and financial futures pits, and there were a lot of reports. A number of the financial publications have touched on this at least once, but they have not in any concerted way tried to analyze what's coming down here. And I think that the probability is that you have a clandestine, I can't call it secret because people know that it's there, but what it does is not discussed. And if I were one of the senators running the Senate Finance Committee or in the House side, House Financial Services, I'd have them in, and I'd ask them about this.
So for people, again, let me get this straight. The Fed has a group that it seems, when it feels the need to throw some money at the markets to affect the way a day or a week will end up looking. Is that really what is going on?
And it's not just the Fed.
Oh, okay.
No, the president's working group singles out two people for prominence, and others are sort of floating. And the two are the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Now, at this point in time, 2007, 2008, it's clear that the more important mover is Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary. Bernanke is a lesser figure. Certainly in the Washington power structure, Paulson is much heavier. So what you have is a close cooperation and, I'm sure, discussion between the Treasury Secretary and the Fed Chairman, and they don't have to have it while they're sitting in the meeting room of the President's Working Group. They can have it some other place. But I think what you have seen over the last 20 years intermittently is that these two power centers in government, Treasury and the Federal Reserve, have probably intervened in the markets, always to the benefit of the financial sector, and kept market forces from operating. So we have, in essence, sort of loaded dice.
Yeah. In other words, certainly anyone who listens to my show knows that we constantly point out that the what's called market capitalism or the free market is not, that it's fudged here, it's fudged there. But this was a new fudge that was news to me. Let me ask you, because you do deal about it in some length in the book, and then I want to leave time for one big question at the end. How does oil fit into this?
Well, oil is a very central component of what's circling the United States. I think of it as six or seven sharks in the water, and you know, one of them is financialization. The second is the huge amount of debt. Third is the global commodity inflation. Fourth, home prices collapsing. But fifth, you have a very important aspect of oil, which in turn relates to the dollar. The United States was the major oil power in the world from, the decades after the Civil War up to the 1970s. And oil was central to Allied victory in World Wars I and II, and central to America's industrial triumph, even to the laying out of America's transportation system and then residential complex. And since the 1970s, we've started to lose control over oil. The first stage was when OPEC got its price increase in the early 1970s, and Nixon and Kissinger at that time cut a deal that in return for the increase, and it was a very small early increase in oil relative to the incredible numbers we have now, that what the OPEC powers, principally Saudi Arabia, agreed to do was that oil would be priced, bought and sold globally, in dollars, and that the OPEC members, especially the Saudis, would recycle their petrodollars, their profits, and put them back in the United States in the form of buying treasury debt, and that would reinforce the dollar. Now, this worked, I suppose, reasonably well up until the period right before the invasion of Iraq, but a lot of the oil producers saw the invasion of Iraq as having a secondary motive, try to get a hold of all of Iraq's oil and dump it on the market to bring the price down. Didn't work. It boomeranged. The price went up 500% in the 5 years after the war. And OPEC is disgusted with the United States and doesn't believe what the people in charge say. And as a result, they have let the price ratchet up. And as the price goes up, oil has become a drag on the dollar as opposed to a prop for the dollar. And right. That's producing a major problem here.
Right. And in fact, people are now jumping ship. Countries are jumping ship and no longer exchanging in dollars. I don't think I have time for one question that I'm going to leave out there. If we have time at the end, I'm going to ask you to come back to it, which, as you just referred to it, the invasion of Iraq. How does the invasion and occupation of Iraq and our bloated defense budget affect our financial standing? Lave that one aside, because I want to ask a bigger question.
Okay.
What does it mean, and this is what I observe, that greed and cleverness have led leaders and significant players in the corporate sphere, we saw it with Enron, WorldCom, Adelphi, et cetera, where they were doing things off the books, they were creating dummy companies, and the accounting companies that were supposed to be watching them were not. Then we look at the government and defense spheres. We have a war started on false pretenses. We have a war funded through emergency supplemental, so neither Congress nor the military has to deal with real accountability on the money they're spending. And now we see the financial sphere in this credit crisis, basically a lot of similarities. Moody's and those who are rating the bonds don't really know what they're rating, so no one is really watching. The financial players are creating instruments that are created perhaps solely because they escape regulation, and we now see. So what I'm saying is corporate, financial, government, military, at the leadership at the top levels of all of these powerful players are dealing in greed, cleverness, and deceit. What does that say about us as a country and our leadership?
Well, unfortunately, if you go back in American history, you see elements of this before. You certainly could have seen it in the Civil War when the greed in supplying the troops was unbelievable. Other examples. But having said that, I think that the combination here is especially powerful because a lot of it ties into the question of financialization. That's a major problem for the government because they've lost control over elements of the economy and the budget, and they like to fake things. The corporate people are so tied into finance because they get their money out of bonuses and they worry about their stock price much more than what they produce. And the long and the short is that the dishonesty that's emerged in the financial sector has emerged at the same time as, first, the financial sector has become the dominant component of the economy, and secondly, the financial sector has escaped regulation, because it's typical when you have a new emerging sector. We saw this with railroads and manufacturing 100 years ago, that they escaped regulation. It's
time
to get it back on.
I've got to go. The book is Bad Money. The website is bad-money.com. Thank you, Kevin Phillips. Keep up the good work.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In the second half, you'll hear my 2007 conversation with economist Robert Frank about two of his books. First, he looks at the real world and asks real questions in The Economic Naturalist, in search of explanations for everyday enigmas. It's his way of teaching economic principles. And second, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class, in which Frank examined financial and consumer trends that would contribute in their own way to the crash of 2008.
Hello, I'm Terry McNally, and welcome to Free Forum. Got a couple of questions for you. Why do the keypads on drive-up cash machines have braille dots? These are drive-up cash machines, and yet you've noticed them. They have dots for the blind. Here's another one. Why do brides spend a small fortune on gowns they're only going to wear once, while grooms just go out and they and the whole male party rent tuxes? Why one is a purchase, a massive purchase, and the other is a rental? For decades, economist Robert Frank has been asking his economic students at Cornell University to pose and answer questions like these as a way of learning how economic principles actually operate in the real world, which they do, everywhere, all the time. Students have to write an essay explaining such everyday occurrences and oddities in economic terms. Well, after years of collecting these, Frank picked the best of the thousands of essays that his students had turned in, and we're talking about students from freshman year to PhD candidates, and he combined those with some of his own examples to create a book, The Economic Naturalist, In Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. And he hopes and suspects that this book will help people retain basic economic principles better than an introductory course. Another book just out by Robert Frank is called Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. Now, although middle-income families don't earn much more than they did several decades ago, they're buying bigger cars, bigger houses, bigger appliances, the newest high-tech gadgets. They're moving into neighborhoods to get better schools, and to pay for them, they spend more than they earn. They carry record levels of debt. Today, on the news, there was an announcement of that's the thing that is rising the fastest in this economy right now is consumer debt. So in the book Falling Behind, Robert Frank explores the very meaning of happiness and prosperity in America today and explains how increased concentrations of income and wealth at the top of the economic pyramid have set off kind of trickle-down expenditures for the less well-off, and thus putting themselves, as I said, into enormous debt. Robert Frank is a professor of management and professor of economics at the Johnson Graduate School of Management, Cornell University. His Economic Scene column appears monthly in the New York Times. He's the author of Choosing the Right Pond, The Winner-Take-All Society, Luxury Fever, The Economic Naturalist, and the newest, Falling Behind. Robert Frank, welcome to KPFK and Free Forum.
Nice to be with you, Terry.
Okay. Let's start off just by answering those first two questions that may have piqued people's curiosity. Why do keypads at drive-in ATMs have braille dots? And why do brides buy their gowns while grooms rent their tuxes?
Those two are actually two of my favorite questions of all time. The first one was submitted by my student, Bill Joa. And his suggested answer was that the manufacturing companies are going to make the machines with braille dots on the keypads for their walk-up locations in any event. Once they've got themselves set up to make those machines, he reasoned, it's just quicker and easier to make one kind of machine rather than hold two separate inventories and worry about getting the right ones to the right destinations. That might be worth doing if the drivers suffered any inconvenience as a result of the braille dots on the keypads, but they clearly don't. So it's just cheaper and easier to do it all the same way. That was a good answer. Took less than a page. That story's been told, I'm sure, by his classmates and their successors thousands of times when they went home to visit with their families. It's just another way of getting the cost-benefit way of thinking drilled into your head in a much more intuitive form than it would be if it came in through an equation or a graph.
Right. And as you referred there to the economic principle that everyday situation deals with, which is cost-benefit analysis. And
that's right.
It might be the same.
The second question you mentioned is also a nice illustration of the cost-benefit principle. I'll just elaborate briefly on the question. What makes it even more interesting is that the bride spends thousands of dollars knowing full well she'll never wear the dress again, while the groom, who's sure he'll have scores of occasions in the future to wear formal wear, rents a cheap suit. What's going on here? The interesting questions are the ones that have that element of paradox about them. It just seems that it's the bride who ought to be renting and the groom who should be buying here. That one was submitted by Jennifer Dulski in 1997. She had gotten married 6 months before and I imagine had pondered the very question in her experience. And so what her suggested answer was that if you think about big social occasions like weddings, it's more important for women, she argued, to make a fashion statement than it is for men. That's an assumption. You could argue with it, but most people seem to accept it at face value. It seems to describe the situation in most countries. If you'll take that opening assumption at face value, then what it implies about the rental business is pretty interesting. If you wanted to make a fashion statement in a rental gown, the company would have to hold on stock, 50, 75, 100 gowns in each size to give you enough choice to feel you could do that. The gowns would rent out every 5, 6, 7 years. The cost of carrying that idle inventory would be so high they'd have to charge 110, 115% of the purchase price as a rental fee. And if they did that, nobody would rent. They'd all buy. The guys, if they're willing to wear the same style suit everyone else wears, they don't care, apparently. The rental company can stock 2 or 3 suits in each size. They turn over 6, 7 times a year. The rental rate for the suit then is as low as 20, 25% of the purchase price of the suit. And if you're trying to save a few bucks on that occasion, there's a good chance to do it.
So okay.
It's a nice explanation. It's coherent. It's a narrative. You can get your mind around it. What we know, Terry, is that narratives slide into the brain like a key into a lock. When we teach the traditional freshman course in economics, there are 1,000 different ideas thrown out there for students, many of them embedded in the form of equations and graphs. And the human mind just doesn't absorb information that efficiently in that format. So what we know, unfortunately, is that after 6 months, if students are given tests that probe their knowledge of basic economic principles, the ones who took the course don't score any better than the ones who never took it at all. That's pretty low bar to beat, I think. I think if we can get them telling economic stories, they're going to do better than that.
Well, I think this is quite interesting, and it's what I noticed in your answers was you didn't merely answer the question. You answered the question and actually gave a little critique of the explanation itself. You actually are contributing part of the proceeds of the book to the writing program at Cornell?
This writing assignment that I've given my students for the last 15 years or so grew out of a program I participated in the early 80s. It was the Knight Institute's sponsored program at Cornell for writing in the disciplines. Their belief was that the best way to learn about an idea is to write about it, so that the only writing courses shouldn't be the freshman writing seminar or the English courses that you take, but you should actually write about the ideas you're trying to learn in the disciplines. And so they gave me a teaching assistant to help with the grading, and I assigned 20-page papers, which once I lost my TA began to shrink in size. I kept them, though, because I could tell that the students got much more engaged with the subject matter when they were writing about it.
Okay, and I would guess...
Now the papers are only a page long, and they're better still. You know, they're crisp. They think about an interesting question. You know, I insist to them that I don't want to read the answer to the question if the question itself isn't interesting. So, it's, you know, they've got to think about a lot of things they're looking at when they walk around in the world to come up with an interesting question. And then once they've done that, though, they're on their way. They'll put a lot of energy into coming up with an economically plausible account for what's going on in this seeming paradox. And the results are they've got things to talk about with friends and family and argue about. And each time they tell the story, it just gets a little bit more firm in their mind, the underlying principle.
Right. Now, you mentioned the research that was done on conventional economic teaching and the lack of retention. How about have you tested the retention based on this use of narrative?
You know, that's exactly the right question to pose, and I wish I could show you a voluminous data set where we'd proven conclusively that this really does work in the way I think it does. We're working on designing the set of questions that would satisfy economists that if students can answer these, that means they've retained what we really care about. So I hope to have an answer to that question before too long. But in the meantime, what I can tell you anecdotally is that students have been coming back for reunion. Oh, every year I'll see a set of former students. They'll come by my office just to say hello. And in so many cases, they'll say, I've got this great question I thought up, and what do you think of this answer to it? You know, so they're out there. They're still thinking about the things they run into in their everyday experience, trying to apply their basic economic principles to them. If they're doing that, you know, I don't think they're losing ground as the years go by. I think they're getting better at economics.
Okay.
But we'll see once we have the formal test. You asked a good question.
Right. Let me tell people, I'm your host, Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Robert Frank. Robert is the author of several books, including Luxury Fever, a favorite of mine, and two books that are out right now, The Economic Naturalist and his newest, Falling Behind. And the subtitle for Falling Behind is How Rising Inequality is Harming the Middle Class. And you can learn more about Robert's work at robert-h-frank.com, robert-h-frank.com. I must say that you've tapped into one of my passions, making the distinction between learning by pie charts and graphs versus learning by story. I actually speak about this and teach this. And so I'm going to get on my soapbox for a moment and just emphasize what you're saying. It's a matter of history that basically we learned everything that helped us survive and helped our cultures of our various clans and tribes survive by storytelling. There was no other way to pass on the essential information. So in some sense, our brains might even be hardwired for that. That, as I say, if you look at a child, you start telling them stories, which most good parents do, and they pretty quickly, once they can speak, and probably even before they can speak, start telling stories to their stuffed animals, to their imaginary friends, or they tell their own stories back to you. And you'll notice it's years before they start using abstract logic and numbers and that sort of thing. And I sort of say that storytelling is our native language. Your thoughts?
You know, That's right on target, Terry. The learning theorist Jerome Bruner, he's a psychologist, very distinguished psychologist, and he's been a pioneer in the narrative theory of learning research. And he's written that if a child doesn't capture an experience in narrative form, if he doesn't sort of embed it in a story, then it's just not available to him later on. He can't dredge it up from memory and mull it over and think about it and learn from it. It's just lost. If the experience is coded in story form, then it's accessible. He can bring it up when a similar experience occurs to him and sort of compare this one to that one and make his decisions in the light of what he learned the last time. And the evolutionary psychologists agree completely with your characterization of it. We evolved as storytellers. You know, we didn't squat down and start drawing graphs and equations with a stick in the sand. You know, we just told each other stories. That's how the brain is wired to receive information. It just gets in there naturally that way. Now, I don't want to make that a wrap against technical analysis and following through the full implications of the logical sequences. No, I mean, we've made enormous progress by our ability to go beyond narrative. But if you're trying to learn the guts of a few simple ideas for the first time, why swim upstream? Why not go with the natural strength of the brain, which is the narrative structure? If you can get those ideas wrapped into a story with actors, a plot, something that has a noticeable flow of events that people can wrap their minds around, then they're not going to have to struggle to comprehend the idea. It's just going to be part of them without effort almost.
Okay. And listeners, if you thought what you were going to get was just economic theory today, this piece that Robert and I are talking about right now, I think, is going to be really valuable to you. A metaphor to think about, if you are in the business in your personal or professional life of imparting information to your workers, to your colleagues, et cetera, maybe even to your spouse, then think of it as a necklace. And if the facts that you want someone to remember are the beads, the story is the string. And you take this, you know, you disconnect the string of a string of pearls and you've got chaos. But as long as it's together, you've got something that holds it together and keeps it working for you. Let me ask you, you say that there are basically 4, 5, 6 maybe principal ideas in economics. Can I ask you briefly to illustrate each of them with a brief reference to an anecdote, and then we will go to talking about falling behind and the effect of rising fortunes of the rich on the static fortunes of the middle class.
Okay, here I'm going to step in and suggest that since we only do have a limited amount of time, it might be better to do a couple of principles well than
great
to do
exactly
5 or 6.
Okay, so you're going to pick a couple, and
so,
then folks,
so, you know, I'll sort of work my way down the list, and we'll see how far
okay,
we get.
Okay, very good.
The cost-benefit principle is by far the most important one. You could almost say that all the other ones are derivative of it.
And we've already illustrated that one with a couple.
And that one's shown up already in the two examples we've discussed. So, no real problem wrapping your mind around that one for most people. But, you know, the details matter. I mean, to apply it correctly in context is not always that easy. So another important principle, let me pose a question. We'll see what we can do to answer it. Why my student Jonathan Chang wanted to know, are brown eggs more expensive than white ones? That's true here anyway. He cited data from our local supermarket that brown eggs, grade A, large, were 79 cents a dozen more than white ones. And that's interesting, and typically economists use the supply and demand model to try and answer questions about why things cost what they do. And there's a principle that I call the no cash on the table principle. That means that there shouldn't be an easy opportunity for somebody who doesn't bring some special talent or a willingness to work hard to the table to just walk away with extra cash that's just lying around. If markets are working, all the easy opportunities will have been taken up. So the explanation we want to offer for why brown eggs sell for more than white eggs shouldn't violate this no cash on the table principle. If brown eggs cost the same to produce as white eggs, we'd have a paradox, because then the question would be, well, why are producers even offering white eggs? They could make more money by producing only brown eggs. And since the cost, if you assume the cost is the same of the two kinds of eggs, since the brown eggs sell for more, they'd have higher profits. So it can't be true, if you believe in the no cash on the table principle, that the two eggs cost the same to produce, he reasoned. And so he did some digging and found that, sure enough, the eggs laid by hens that have brown shells are typically laid by bigger hens than the hens that lay white eggs. The bigger hens eat more. It costs the poultry farmers more to produce each egg, therefore, and so the cost of production of brown eggs is higher. Well, then the question is, why do consumers pay extra for brown eggs if they taste the same and have the same nutritional content? And there's no ready answer, but unless consumers were willing to pay more, the two eggs couldn't sell for different colors because consumers would buy only white eggs in
right
this case. Some consumers must think brown eggs are better. Maybe they're wrong, or maybe they just like the looks of brown eggs. I'm embarrassed to say we buy brown eggs. You know, I feel like I know enough to think, hey, what am I getting here? I'm not getting a premium product. Why am I paying extra? I think my wife likes the look of the brown eggs.
I'm wondering if on that one, because I love the fact that you choose an example of which you actually still end up with a mystery. But maybe part of it is the very fact that there are less of them because, and they cost more, make people think there's something to it.
Yeah, maybe the mere fact that they're more expensive makes people think they're getting a premium product. But in fact, they are kind of pretty. And you know, nobody balks when somebody's willing to pay more for a hotel room with a nice view than
right.
for a room on the other side that looks out at the alleyway. So if you think they're prettier, that's fine if you're willing to pay more for them.
Right. And my guess is they also have a core that people assume, this would be my guess, that people assume they're more natural. That would just be my guess. And so, you know.
Yeah. No, that's an association. Brown rice is better for you than mm-hmm. white rice. So mm-hmm. why not here too?
Right. Okay. I'll tell you what.
That could be.
At this point, let's skip to the other book because I think people are getting the sense now of what we're talking about with the economic naturalist is looking at the real world and asking real-world questions, finding economic answers for them in a way that is in narrative form. So if this has been at all interesting to you, the book is The Economic Naturalist, In Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. And as we've talked about, if you, like 99% of other people, remember things better when they're told in story form, this will be your chance to finally master some of the economics that slipped through your brain over the years. I'm going to remind you that you're listening to Free Forum. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with economist Robert Frank, author of Luxury Fever, The Economic Naturalist, and his newest that just came out recently, Falling Behind. You can learn more about all of his work at robert-h-frank.com. And for audios of this and previous shows, you can go to temcnally.livedigital.com and look at content and audio. It'll also be archived for 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archives. Scroll down by date and time. Now, Falling Behind, it seems to me, is an interesting analysis of a phenomenon that has been taking place in the U.S. over the last few years, really coming to sharp relief as the top 1%, top 5%, top 10% seem to be getting enormous gains, economic gains, in both salaries and wealth, while the middle class, the working class, seem to be making occasionally minor increases and then falling back and so on, almost a static line for the last few years. And yet what you're saying is that doesn't just affect the very rich, it affects the middle class, even though they haven't really lost relative to where they themselves were. Is that a good setup?
Yeah, that's a good summary of the main theme of the book. And it's not quite correct to say they haven't lost, because I think they have lost something very important, even though as we conventionally measure their purchasing power, they seem to have a little bit more now than they did 30 years ago. I think some of the basic goals that most middle-class families are trying to achieve are harder to achieve in the current environment than they used to be.
Okay, one of the things that I often...
So in that sense, I think they have lost.
Yeah, I say in that regard that people do seem to be able to buy the newest, you know, electronic gadget, but things like healthcare, college education, and their own home get harder and harder, the things that made this country what it is in the 50s.
That's right. And so, yeah, if you're a parent, your main concern is you want your kids to get a good start. You want to make sure you buy a house in a safe neighborhood with good schools. The cost of doing that relative to your income is vastly higher now than it was 30 years ago. And in the book, I argue that the primary reason for that is that the real gains in income have occurred almost exclusively at the very top of the income ladder. You mentioned the top 1, the top 10, the top 20%. If you go beyond the top 20%, you don't see much in the way of significant gains. But the really important story is that the big gains have not been in the top 1%, but in the top 0.1%. And even higher up, we see more spectacular gains. It's been a real pyramiding of income and wealth the last 30 years.
I know. And one of the things that often when one looks at economic numbers in the press and so on, very often everything is aggregated. So, you know, when they say incomes have increased, when they say wealth has increased, when they say the GDP has increased, it's just these huge numbers that...
It's the average.
Exactly. Yeah.
But that doesn't tell you what's happened to the guy in the middle. The median family earns about the same as it did 30 years ago. A little bit more, but not much more.
Yeah, the statistic I often say, yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that real earnings for Americans rose steadily from World War II to 1973, and basically 73 to 2007, which now puts us at a lot of years, that increase has been minor, if at all.
That's right. Yeah, you've nailed it. It was 3% a year for everybody, rich, poor, middle, alike. In the post-war years, those three decades were a good high-growth, even-growth period. Since the early 70s, probably maybe even a few years before that it started, virtually all the significant gains have gone to the top.
And so
that's had practical consequences for people in the middle.
Right. So if I give you like 2 minutes to really tell us the key important things that you want people to get out of falling behind, what would those be?
Well, I'd say, first of all, don't get angry at the rich for buying lavish things. Everybody in every circle has a different frame of reference. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal, and I lived in a house that people would be ashamed to live in here. I thought it was a great house when I was living in Nepal. If people in Nepal could see my house here, which is not an elaborate house by American standards by any means, they would think I'd totally lost my senses. Why would anyone need such a house, they'd say. So spending is very local. Standards are local. So the rich have more money. Of course, they're buying bigger mansions. That's just what people do when they get more money. They buy bigger and better. The people in the middle aren't angry about that. They think they'll be rich or hope they'll be rich someday, so they like to see pictures of the mansions. The people just below the top, though, are influenced by the bigger mansions. Now, it might be somebody just below the top wanted to build 40,000 square feet himself but was embarrassed to do it. Now, somebody richer built 70,000 square feet. He's free to build his 40,000 square foot house and won't even attract any complaints from it. Or it may be that the richest people now have such big houses, they've started having their daughters' wedding receptions in the home. And now we need to be able to do that, too, because we travel in the same circle. We need to build bigger. And then there's a layer just below us, and they need to build bigger. Now the median home is about a third bigger than it was in 1980. And there's been no gain in income. Why has it gotten bigger? The simplest hypothesis is that it's because of that cascade of expenditures launched in the first instance by spending at the top. And
okay.
The rub for the median family is they can't afford the median house any longer, and that's the house you need to buy if you want your kids to go to at least average quality schools. So you either go into debt, take your savings down to nothing, commute longer distances, work longer hours, all these margins people are working to try to make basic ends meet to achieve the goal that every family wants to achieve, get your kids into a decent school.
Okay. Having used that big example of housing and schools and so on, I think you can get the sense of what we're talking about here. And I'm just going to make one statement, and then I've got to close, and I just want your agreement with this. It struck me as we were talking that if credit cards and the huge credit industry had not come along in these 30 years when wages for the middle and working classes have stayed static, we might have had a lot more social unrest in this country.
You know, I think the ability to borrow sometimes forces you to borrow. So I think if you're trying to keep up and others are spending more and they're spending more because they can borrow, that puts pressure on you to do likewise.
And so you don't notice.
Every time there was I think if there hadn't been that ready access to credit, we'd have actually been better off.
That's what I'm saying, is that you don't notice it quite the same, and that both those things have moved in parallel. Okay, let me tell you.
People felt forced to borrow.
That's right, and didn't feel it quite the same as if they hadn't been able to. So again, the books are The Economic Naturalist and Falling Behind. The website is robert-h-frank.com. I look forward to being with you again next week. Robert Frank, keep up the good and interesting work.
Thanks, Terry. Look forward to talking to you again.
If you want 24/7 access to everything Progressive on the mobile internet, download the Progressive Voices app at progressivevoices.com. The PV app is a one-stop shop that aggregates everything Progressive: news, blogs, audio, video, opinion, then thoughtfully curates, prioritizes, and presents the Progressive content. The purpose is to create a progressive media universe, an alternative to the one controlled by cable operators, radio station owners, and newspaper publishers. That's the PV app at progressivevoices.com.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on by joining our community. Each week, we send out an email that covers important things taking place in the Progressive Voices Network and throughout the progressive world. Be the first to know of upcoming shows, schedule changes, exclusive programming, and more. Simply go to progressivevoices.com and sign up for our mailing list. It's that easy. Progressivevoices.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining the Progressive Voices community.